Welcome back. Remember, if you bought a house anywhere but Santa Barbara, you didn't pay enough, unless maybe you bought a house in New York City, where Will Parker writes about the housing and the residential rental market. He was previously a reporter and special projects editor at the Real Deal, where he focused on the intersection of New York City real estate and politics. I like the phrase of the intersection there, incorporating real estate. Recently, he's written a lot on the rental market. Welcome to Radio Real Estate, Will Parker.
Hey, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're so welcome. I discovered you in some articles you wrote, but in the past few years, I've interviewed Candace Taylor, who writes more on estates. And so how would you distinguish yourself from what you write about and how she approaches real estate?
Yeah, so Candace has written a lot about the for sale housing market, right? So, you know, people buying homes. I tend to focus on the world of rent, renters and rental investors.
Okay, good. And one of the topics we're going to talk about is corporations buying rentals and HOAs trying to fight that. I have my list of guests in alphabetical order with their first name, but you're not last. I interviewed Jonas Freemark. Do you know him?
I know his name, yeah.
Yeah, he's a writer in the business there, so you're right at the bottom there. No relation to Peter Parker?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
You know who Peter Parker is?
No, I know who he is. I just don't know if we're related. That's what I'm...
He's the fictional character. He's Spider-Man?
Yeah, I know that. I've heard that one before, you might imagine.
Yeah, I apologize for being so rudimentary and sophomoric. What about Fess Parker? You're related to Fess Parker?
That's the Dickens character?
No, he was actually an actor who lived in Santa Barbara. He was a guest on this program. He owns a lot of real estate, owns a winery. His son and daughter are alive. He was a TV character in the 50s. He played Daniel Boone and another character. He's the real deal, Fess Parker.
Oh, Fess, F-E-S-S, okay.
Yeah.
I'm looking him up now, good-looking guy. No, not familiar with him.
Yeah, he was a very nice guy, very nice guy. So some of the articles you've written, one was about underused office buildings getting a new life. What's going on with that?
Yeah, so when the pandemic hit and no one was going to the office anymore, there were a lot of concerns basically everywhere that this was going to be really bad for office landlords, right? People in leases wouldn't renew. Office landlords would, you know, get in serious financial trouble, and that maybe one thing that we'd be able to do with these emptying office buildings is turn them into housing. Which is a new thing, right? And we've seen that happen in cities all over the country. It's certainly happened in New York and in Los Angeles over the years. But the idea is that this would be an opportunity to do much more of it on a much bigger scale. And universally, people agree that there's not enough housing in cities, and this would be a way to up the supply.
And have you found that local cities and zoning ordinances are willing to bend and bend the rules and make it happen?
Yeah, well, that's where it gets complicated. I mean, the local rules is just one aspect of it. You know, certainly you have to have city governments that are willing to bend a little bit to make it easier to do. You know, to get the zoning variances, you need to change from commercial to residential. And there are places that have tried to make it easier for people to do that. Certainly some states and cities are friendlier to developers trying to do that than others. But it's also just enormously expensive to do that. And very, very often developers find that it's cheaper to tear something down and start over than it is to actually try to convert an existing building. So you really have to find, seems like, you know, talking to developers who do this, you really have to find the perfect building to make it work.
I agree with you. It can be very expensive. My guest, Will Parker, Wall Street Journal reporter. I know California, I don't have it really on the front burner in my head, but I know that there's some new laws they passed trying to encourage this and trying to get local municipalities to go along. Guest next week is the new owner of Nordstrom's downtown Santa Barbara at the end of the Paseo Nuevo Mall. And I'm sure he's been hearing from a lot of people with suggestions. But, you know, when you build a building one way, it's like you said, it's very, very expensive. But some people love living downtown.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one thing that has to be considered here is that demand for downtown, because I think the hope a lot of people had, and certainly some politicians spoke to this to some extent, was that, you know, this would be an opportunity not just to make more housing, but to make affordable housing, right? That cities need more affordable housing, and what if we could turn office buildings into affordable housing? But there hasn't been a huge move to really subsidize, right, to subsidize that kind of affordable housing. So largely what people build with these conversions is, you know, high-end luxury, you could call it, or, you know, certainly market-rate housing. There's not a lot of, you know, deeply affordable conversion projects happening for the time being.
You know, it occurred to me as we were talking that people were, due to the pandemic, working at home, and then suddenly the office becomes a dinosaur. But I think Seinfeld, it was an episode where George Costanza was living under his desk. He had a little alarm clock and food. So maybe you can just turn the office and the people can still work from home, but they're working from home at the office. Kind of combine it from the two. My guest, Will Parker, Wall Street Journal reporter.
You joke about that, but there's an office building in Virginia I found that actually has people living on the same floor as office spaces. So it's a little bit closer to the Seinfeld reality than even maybe you thought.
Well, you know, I mean, it's certainly you're not commuting, it could be very attractive if you have a nice view downtown, you want to live downtown, you have parking, and, you know, a lot of people might embrace that. I don't see the downside for local municipalities, but I'm sure there are. Will Parker, my guest, Wall Street Journal reporter. So anything to tie a bow on that, or can I ask you another question about a different topic?
Yeah, just that I think, you know, the optimism about how much office conversion of apartments can realistically happen is probably dampening somewhat. It's just, you know, in practice, it's incredibly expensive and difficult, and so there's really only ever going to be a limited amount of it happening, absent some sort of, you know, tremendous subsidy coming in for it, I think.
Right, right. We had a building right downtown was occupied by off Saks Fifth Avenue. It became a off Saks Fifth Avenue, and it was bought with the same ideas. People were thinking about it, but again, you know, so expensive. I did read there was something in Paris that was it an old hotel or a commercial building where they added stories and added residential right in downtown Paris. I don't know if you read about that.
I didn't, no.
I'll have to find that and I'll send it to you. Very, very interesting. It was a very big deal probably about a year or two ago. Wall Street Journal reporter Will Parker is my guest. You wrote another article on April 11th and then updated it today about home builders competing with individual home buyers. And by say home builders, I mean like corporate home buyers. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm misreading this. Home buyers bypassing individual home buyers for deep-pocketed investors, acing out the home buyer. What are the deep-pocketed investors doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think most people are familiar with how investors have started buying more existing homes, right? And that became more of a trend after the financial crisis. Has now developed into this, you know, very, very institutionally accepted asset class, like apartment buildings and office buildings have been for decades. But now, you know, in addition to buying up existing homes, you know, your 20 to 30 year old kind of cookie cutter suburban houses, they're also starting to buy brand new construction homes more often. So that happens in a couple different ways. Sometimes, you know, it's buying up a builder's unsold supply from a new subdivision.
Mm-hmm.
Increasingly, it's also planning with the builder from the very beginning. Like, you've got this land, you're looking to build a new subdivision. What if we built them all as rentals? You're seeing a lot more of that too, especially in the Southwest. Arizona is kind of like the capital of doing this for the home building world, and also the Southeast.
Now, on the plus side, you know, we have a shortage of rentals, and apparently Arizona and the Southeast must also. They wouldn't be doing this if they didn't feel they had a market. So there's pros and cons. How are people reacting to it?
Yeah, I mean, you get two very separate reactions to it. I mean, you have people who speak very much along the lines that you just have, you know, obviously people in the real estate industry, but others who, you know, have a very strong feeling about the supply problem in the housing market, who say, more rentals, you know, great. If this money is going to help help increase the overall supply of what's being built, you know, the housing market could use more rentals. Certainly there are people who want to live in these deep suburban areas now who aren't going to be able to buy. Let's build something for them to rent. You know, on the other hand, you have people who see it and are crushed by it. They feel like, you know, this is supposed to be an American dream for someone to be able to buy that house. And if a greater share of what we're building is for investors to purchase, then I think there's a feeling among many people that, you know, that the middle class will ultimately end up losing out as a result of that growing phenomenon.
I would tend to agree with the latter argument that you made, particularly right now, when in my first segment you didn't hear, we have virtually no inventory. Now, we're just a small little market here, but we have no inventory. And prices have just, because of this, skyrocketed. So then if you add corporate buyers and you add people like Picasso, which admittedly they're not going to be buying dozens of homes in Santa Barbara, but they bought two so far, and there's arguably a timeshare. But so you got all these these entities competing with the, you know, mom and pop or pop and pop or mom and mom who want to buy a home. You had written that it's one in five houses were purchased by investors in December or at the end of December 2021, but from...
Right, it's roughly about, you know, one in every five homes sold now.
I mean, that's remarkable. That's a huge percentage.
Yeah, and depending on how you look at it or measure it, I mean, you know, it's never been any higher than this before. It's not clear how much it will continue to rise this year, but it certainly is high as it's ever been.
Yeah, I think from the article you emailed me this morning, somewhere in the 2016 to 2018, it was, I wrote down up 21%. I'm not quite clear what it was, but the trend is clearly it's becoming higher percentage.
Yeah, it's back on the rise. It's gone up and down, you know, a little bit between the end of the financial crisis and now. But yeah, it's been going up since the pandemic, for sure. And in some parts of the country, the rate's even higher, right? So, you know, there were times in the last year where I think the number was closer to one in four in places like Atlanta, for example. A lot of it is concentrated in, you know, really popular, fast-growing markets where, you know, home prices have appreciated.
Wall Street Journal reporter Will Parker is my guest. My cousin Freddie has been on the show. He actually came on once or twice. He talked about the, what was that hurricane on Long Island?
Sandy.
Hurricane Sandy. Do you live in the city?
I do, yes.
Most of my family was born in Brooklyn, and then many moved out to Long Island, some in Manhattan. Or if I was really proper, I would just refer to Manhattan as the city. Am I correct?
Some people do that, yeah.
So my cousin Freddie lives in North Woodmere, Long Island, and their single-family residences, you know, in California, we call a home that's detached a single-family residence. There, they have such rules and regulations that you can't buy that and then rent it out to a bunch of college students. That's in the homeowners associations. And in the article you sent me, you're saying that 21 counties, Florida, Arizona, North Carolina, and Texas, are creating rules to stop investors from buying and renting out single-family homes?
Well, homeowners associations are doing this everywhere. And the statistic you pulled there was a company that pulled data from these associations in those 21 counties in four states where they they see a lot of attempts by homeowners associations to amend their rules, which I think is what you're talking about. And these associations, you know, their powers differ somewhat state to state, but they have pretty broad control over what people can do with their homes, or they can. They have the ability to make pretty restrictive rules. One of the types of rules they can make are have to do with renting and whether an owner has the ability to rent their home at any time that they want to. And yes, we're seeing more of these associations decide to pass new rules to limit how much rental activity can happen in their neighborhoods. And so this is happening at the same time that, you know, investors are buying so many homes in so many different parts of the country.
And to be clear, don't give me any credit for me throwing out these statistics. I simply copy down what you wrote. So this is this is you doing this research. I'm just a parrot here. It seems someone might hear this and say, well, that seems kind of draconian. It's my property. If I buy a house, I should be able to rent it out. It seems to be more acceptable, or accepted, if you will. Like in California, a lot of condo associations have, sometimes you can't rent out anything at all, or right. They only allow a certain percentage to be rented out. And that seems to have been accepted. I'm sure somebody is sued over it, but people aren't used to hearing that, I think, with HOAs in just single family residences.
That's right. I think that's the exact distinction to make, is that it's not what people expect with the detached neighborhood so much. But I think part of it is that, you know, with the spread of Airbnb and short-term rental platforms, for example, and how much that upset, you know, certain homeowners, that some of these associations kind of got together within the last 10 years and made rules on that and, you know, got comfortable or had experience with writing short-term rental rules and have since, in some cases, you know, expanded them to be about long-term rentals as well.
Yeah, it's a sticky wicket for sure. Will Parker writes about the housing and residential rental market based out of New York City. Skyscrapers and everything. Wall Street Journal reporter Will Parker. So we're coming up to the end of our segment here, Will. Anything to add to that topic before I ask you another question?
Yeah, no, I'm interested to get your perspective on it, actually, as a real estate person in California. There's some rules in California now where your neighborhoods aren't going to be able to do this because, you know, your state is encouraging people to build, you know, these accessory dwelling units, right? These small rental units on their property. So you have more rental housing. And obviously you don't want to let neighborhoods then say you can't rent out the ADU you just built in your yard. But, I'm curious, you know, what you hear from homeowners about that issue. You know, the people we talked to, there was some of the classic tension or bias against, you know, renters in suburban neighborhoods that's been around forever, right? Like, you know, the sense that they don't maintain properties as well as the homeowners do, or, you know, that the landlords are more difficult to deal with. But you also, there are a lot of, you know, really sincere, I think, you know, wishes by people who felt like, you know, they wanted homes in their neighborhood to be available to real people to buy, and not just companies. I think the problem is, what about the renters? You know, people have got to have a place to live. There's renters that want to rent in these neighborhoods too. Where do they go? I think, you know, any neighborhood that wants to regulate this, those are the debates that they're having now.
Yes, and it's good of you to bring up California. There were so many accessory dwelling units in California neighborhoods that I think when they pushed to make them a legal entity, I don't think there was really much backlash because they were kind of there already. And I'm not to say that everybody embraced it, but I don't recall reading and hearing about a huge backlash. But this year, what is controversial is they're basically banning single-family residential zoning and saying that depending on the, you could build up to 4 units. And so that's becoming very dicey and receiving some flack. I think you know, if you're honest, you know, there's nothing wrong with a house being rented out, and it's private property, and you have the right to rent your house out. But when you add the element of these corporate buyers coming in and buying a whole housing tract, where you don't even get a chance for a home buyer to buy in, and then I don't know where the happy median is. That's why you pay to write about this, Will, not me. Do you have an opinion on it and where you would like to see it end up?
I mean, certainly, you know, I'm not paid to write about happy mediums either. I kind of try to describe the mess for the rest of you to kind of make up your minds about the best you can, you know. But what's happening in California, what you just described there, other states are looking to do similar things. Minnesota, I believe, is advancing a bill in their state legislature that would, you know, essentially say, you have to let people build duplexes in neighborhoods where you only had single-family homes. Oregon has done something similar. And I think a lot of people, you know, when push comes to shove, when it's in their neighborhood, they may take an opinion or a stance on this that, maybe they wouldn't have an abstract, right? You encounter people who say, of course we should have more affordable housing. That sounds really good. We should have more housing. I understand it's a problem. Then when it comes to, you know, the proposed triplex behind you, sometimes people then have slightly different feelings about it. And so it looks like in California there's been quite a lot of pushback, right? Some towns in Orange County, maybe elsewhere, looking to fight back a little bit on what the state has asked them to do. So, you know, I think you'll see a version of that California fight anywhere else that goes forward with the changes like that.
Good way to tie a bow in it and wrap it up. My guest has been Wall Street Journal reporter Will Parker. I wish we had more time. Next time, maybe we can talk about, because I know you talk a lot about rentals, and it would have dovetailed to what we talked about, and the world's skinniest skyscraper in New York City. Maybe we can do this again, Will.
That would be great. I'd love to. Thanks, Mark.
Okay. Thank you for your time. We'll talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye. Yeah, I heard about the world's skinniest skyscraper, and then I got talking to Jeff Shelton, who built the Ablett Tower on a 20-foot by 20-foot parcel. So we'll see if we have time in the next segment to talk about the world's skinniest skyscraper. But I do have information on Prop 19, straight from Joe Holland, County Tax Assessor. Stay tuned. You'll be right back.